I join House Majority Coalition leadership in calling for Representative Fansler's resignation.
The state House majority responds to the assault charges of one of their own. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 29th. Good evening. I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, how do communities survive a massive tsunami? One answer is pretty simple: knowledge and practice.
They have a long oral history of what to do when the ground shakes for a really long time.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
The fallout from the assault allegations against Bethel Democratic Representative Zach Fansler continued today, with members from both parties calling for him to resign. Fansler didn't show up in the Capitol on the first weekday since the Juneau Empire reported that Juneau Police and the Department of Law were investigating him. The Juneau Empire reports Fansler was drunk and slapped a woman repeatedly, rupturing her eardrum, one when she denied his sexual advances. Anchorage Democratic Representative Ivy Sponholz says at this point, Fansler can't adequately represent his constituents.
I join House Majority Coalition leadership in calling for Representative Fansler's resignation. I think that as leaders, we are called to a higher standard, the highest standard of behavior, ethical and moral.
The House Majority Caucus is scheduled to meet this evening. It will be the first caucus meeting since the allegations became public and could lead to Fansler being removed by the caucus and losing committee assignments. If Fansler doesn't resign, he could be expelled from the House by a two-thirds vote of House members, or 27 of 40. The House Rules Committee also is meeting tonight and could start the expulsion process. Anchorage Republican Representative Charisse Millette says she expects Fansler to, quote, do the right thing and resign.
We have got to stop tolerating this behavior. We have got to stop sweeping it under the rug, and we have got to honor the victims and their bravery coming forward.
House members say they believe Fansler is still in Juneau. It's unclear when or if he will visit the Capitol again. The allegations mark a swift reversal in fortune for Fansler, a freshman Democrat whose election helped shift the balance of power in the House. KYUK's Teresa Katsarilis reports.
The woman who Fansler allegedly assaulted was in an on-and-off-again relationship with him. In an extensive interview with Juneau Empire reporter James Brooks, who broke the story, she says she and Fansler were drinking together on January 13th, before the attack. James Brooks.
From what I'm told, he was drinking heavily, and so she escorted him back up to his hotel room where he was staying. They were kissing, and she was a little reluctant, and so she was trying to put him to bed, and she says he was interested in something more.
The woman says she tried to leave the hotel room.
That's when she says he hit her, pulled her hair.
She started crying and got up to leave. Fansler got up too. He grabbed me so I couldn't leave, she told Brooks, saying she finally escaped Fansler's hotel room after trying to get out for almost an hour. The Juneau Empire corroborated the woman's story with a series of text messages she exchanged with Fansler and with her medical records. She was diagnosed with a ruptured eardrum shortly after the assault. That's when she went to the police and got in touch with reporter James Brooks.
She said that there tends to be a sense of downplaying. You want to say, oh, it wasn't that bad. It couldn't have been as bad as I remember. And she said she concluded after thinking for a while that, yes, it was serious. She felt that it shouldn't be hidden.
Local police and the Department of Law are investigating the alleged assault, and the Juneau PD is expected to release a police report on the incident later this week. House Speaker Bryce Edgman swiftly called for Fansler to resign, only a month after he demanded that another member of his own caucus, Representative Dean Westlake of Kotzebue, resign due to sexual harassment allegations that were later substantiated. According to Fansler's former aide, Benjamin Anderson Agemic, House leadership also stripped Fansler of his legislative staff, who have been reassigned to the House Rules Committee. KYUK could not reach Fansler for comment, but his attorney, Wallace Tetlow of Anchorage, says his client is not planning to resign.
We deny the allegations. They're not true. If charges are filed, we'll deal with those successfully in court.
When the woman told Fansler how badly she'd been injured, he apologized. "I'm embarrassed and ashamed of myself," he wrote in text messages obtained by the Juno Empire. Fansler's district has one of the highest rates of domestic violence in the country, and Fansler has spent years fighting against it. He previously worked as a legal advocate for the Tundra Women's Coalition, a Bethel women's shelter, and managed their Teens Acting Against Violence program. In an interview with KYUK last month, he applauded Representative Dean Westlake's resignation.
"We need to, as Alaskans, be working together to promote a safe culture. We have the worst statistics in the nation, and they're especially bad in our rural regions. And if we can't clean that up, we as a people need to really reevaluate what we're doing."
Bethel community members have, in the past, voiced concerns about Fansler's drinking. When KYUK hosted a live debate for the district's House primary in 2016, several residents requested that we ask Fansler about his alcohol use. Former KYUK reporter Adrian Wagner asked Fansler about it directly.
"We've received concerns from some community members about your relationship with alcohol. How would you like to respond to those concerns?"
I think that, you know, there's always a lot that people struggle with when it comes to the alcohol issue here in this town. And I look forward to us as a region kind of continuing to work on that problem as we see it. So,
I just want to make clear that these community concerns were not about your alcohol policy so much as your personal alcohol use, and they were questions regarding that. Can you respond to that?
"Well, I certainly drink alcohol. Yes, that's true. I don't think I've ever denied that. So."
The Tundra Women's Coalition said they are terribly disappointed to hear these allegations. "We hope that Representative Fansler, who has worked for and supported our programs and has been a role model for many, finds his place of turning around," wrote Director Eileen Arnold. Fansler is fighting to stay in office. If he resigns or is expelled from the legislature, the razor-thin coalition that Fansler helped build in the State House will once again fall to only 21 members, the minimum needed to retain a majority. I'm Teresa Kotsarilis.
The Trump administration has proposed significant cuts to the tsunami warning system. That includes all funding for dozens of sophisticated data buoys. Tsunami experts worry about this, but are even more concerned about proposed cuts to something a whole lot more basic. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin explores what's important and what's crucial in protecting the safety of Alaskans who live along the coast.
A string of 8 communication buoys are anchored off Alaska's southern edge, about 200 miles from land. They're called DART buoys, Deep Ocean Assessment and Reporting of Tsunamis. Each buoy is tethered to an instrument pack on the seafloor. It beams data to a satellite and from there to the tsunami warning centers in Palmer and Honolulu. The U.S. has 39 of these buoys, many along the Pacific Rim. At $12 million a year, state seismologist Michael West says the buoys are both expensive and useful.
"They're the one kind of sensor that really directly measures the wave height, as opposed to inferring it from the presence of an earthquake."
But West says the buoys are too close to Alaska to provide much warning time when a nearshore quake sets off a tsunami.
"Evacuate the high ground immediately."
Last week, the earthquake itself, measured by land-based seismographs, triggered the warning that got thousands of Alaskans out of their homes in the middle of the night. And the Trump budget would cut sensors like those, too. Humboldt State University tsunami expert Lori Dangler says both kinds of technology are important.
The DART buoys are absolutely critical.
The buoys warn distant shores of a tsunami. Alaska generates a lot of earthquakes, so DART is particularly useful to Hawaii, for instance, and to California, where Dangler is.
But in 2011, DARTs were very important for Alaska.
She means when that 9.1 magnitude earthquake hit near Japan.
And when we have our great big Cascadia earthquake, which I hope won't happen in my lifetime, but could, DARTs will be very important for Alaska to know just what we're sending to you.
Beyond the hardware, the Trump budget proposes to eliminate one of the two tsunami warning centers and cut 60% of the personnel. It would also cut grants the states use for tsunami preparation and evacuation plans. Dangler says that kind of spending is critical for an effective warning system.
I'm as concerned about the proposals to cut outreach and education, because to me, without outreach and education, without community involvement, you might as well not spend a penny on any of it.
Good evening. The quake's epicenter was off the island of Sumatra in North.
Dangler says a research trip to Indonesia after the massive 2004 tsunami forever changed her thinking on this. She went to towns where 95% of the residents died.
I spent 2 weeks going to community after community where you'd see one survivor. It was horrible.
Then she went to the village closest to the earthquake epicenter. They had only 8 minutes between the quake and the first massive wave. So she expected the same terrible death toll. But in this village, everyone knew to run to high ground.
I mean, this is a community that's off the grid. There was no tsunami warning. They have no electricity. But they have a long oral history, a long oral tradition of what to do when the ground shakes for a really long time.
If Alaskans think they evacuated for nothing last week, Dangler says they are wrong. People figured out if they were at risk. They found their shelters and thought about evacuation routes. Dangler says they laid down muscle memory about how to get up and go. In the Indonesian village that survived in 2004, Dangler says it had been 5 generations since the previous killer tsunami, but residents still ran after every major earthquake. One time they waited on high ground for a week and no wave came. Dangler recalls asking if they worried about false warnings.
And they looked at me as if I was absolutely crazy and said, every earthquake is a chance to practice our evacuation. And on December 26, 2004, they got it. You know, practice paid off. They all lived.
Dangler says whether the warning comes via cell phone, siren, or prolonged shaking, the important thing is to evacuate low-lying areas and leave fast, every time. The U.S. Department of Commerce declined to make anyone available for an interview about the proposed cuts to the tsunami warning system. In a written statement, a department spokesman said the cuts streamline elements of the program while ensuring safety. Congress has not adopted the tsunami warning cuts. Lawmakers have been keeping the government operating with a series of temporary measures that continue spending at last year's levels. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a rock band with Alaska roots wins its first Grammy.
This is crazy for us. Our heroes were dog mushers and stuff like that. This is nuts.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Federal Subsistence Board is accepting applications through February 2nd to fill seats on the 10 Subsistence Regional Advisory Councils. Councils meet at least twice a year and provide critical advice to the board on subsistence management issues. Individuals may apply or nominate someone for membership. More at doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456. This message is sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
The Alaska legislature is still trying to solve the state's fiscal woes, and while lawmakers debate new taxes and drawing from the permanent fund, oil prices marched steadily upward in January. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more on how news of those higher prices is resonating in Juneau.
2 days ago, the price of Alaska's oil jumped above $70 per barrel for the first time in 3 years, and that's big news in Juneau. Some Senate Republicans point to those rising oil prices as an argument to bolster their reluctance to vote for an income tax. State Tax Division Director Ken Alper says if prices stay in that range through next June, the state expects to bring in about $200 million more than previously thought. But when I asked him if he thought it was going to make a big dent in the deficit...
No, that will cover a little less than one-tenth of the deficit, which is estimated at $2.5 billion.
That deficit has been hounding lawmakers for years now. They've cut the budget, they've argued over new taxes. Meanwhile, they've been drawing billions out of the state's savings accounts for the last 4 years.
We're getting near the bottom of the barrel of those funds.
Alper says there really isn't enough money left in those savings accounts to cover the budget deficit for another year. But there is a chance that the legislature could cobble together just enough money to cover next year's budget deficit without taxing Alaskans or tapping into the permanent fund. It turns out that one of those savings accounts, the Constitutional Budget Reserve, isn't completely tapped. It'll have about $2.1 billion in it by the end of this fiscal year. Add that to the $200 million the state could bring in from higher oil prices, and that budget gap gets much smaller. But when I ask the state's budget director, Pat Pitney, why lawmakers can't just rely on savings for one more year, she says it would be a bad idea to drain that budget reserve.
We don't want to spend that down to zero. That is the shock absorber account for the state's finances.
Pitney says that budget reserve is essentially the savings account the state uses to cover the gap between when its income rolls in and when it has to pay its bills. It's basically the state's cash flow account. Spend that down to zero, and if something goes wrong, like widespread damage from an earthquake or a tsunami, there's nothing to fall back on. There are a few other places lawmakers could look for more money, but they could be as politically unpopular as tapping into the permanent fund. One is to drain the $1 billion the state has in a fund that subsidizes the high cost of rural energy in the state, and the other is a few hundred million used to fund merit scholarships for Alaska college students. But Pitney says that pulling together one more year of balancing the budget on savings doesn't solve the problem of the state having a budget that is tied so firmly to oil prices.
Hoping for the next dollar of oil is just putting our future on hold.
Pitney says the reality of a week or a month of higher oil prices can be totally outweighed by a month of low oil prices. She says the state is past the time when it can hope for oil prices to save it. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
There have been numerous attempts recently to sidestep U.S. Forest Service management of the Tongass National Forest. Senator Lisa Murkowski has a few plans in the works. And now the state of Alaska is petitioning for more attention to be given to a very old debate. The roadless rule was created to protect wilder areas on federal lands. But critics say it limits access to timber and mining in Southeast, putting jobs at risk. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
If you listened to Governor Bill Walker's State of the State speech last week, you might have caught it. Peppered among tidbits about a natural gas pipeline and budget concerns, there was this.
Today, my administration filed a petition with the U.S. Department of Agriculture to undertake a rulemaking process to restore the roadless rule exemption to the region.
Which could give Alaska a pass to build new roads in the Tongass. And that's only the latest effort to increase access to logging. Even by state forester standards, there's been a lot to follow.
It's very complicated. You could do a half hour just on the history of this.
That's Chris Mache. We could have easily talked longer than a half hour about the roadless rule, but he had plans for dinner. He says the state is asking the Department of Agriculture to open up the issue for more public discussion. If approved, Mache estimates it's a process that could take 2 years or longer. And while this tactic might be different than what the state's tried before, he says the ask isn't anything new. Mache says there's a legal and economic argument to be made. Alaska should be exempt from the roadless rule.
Well, the state's always had the position and never has wavered from that.
The petition here really stands to kind of turn back the clock and undo a lot of the good work that has been done over the last several years.
That's Austin Williams, a director of law and policy at Trout Unlimited, a conservation group. Sticking with the current Forest Service plan for the Tongass, Williams says, makes the most sense. It was created with years of community input and finalized in 2016, outlining a transition away from cutting old growth trees. Williams says the economy in the region has shifted to industries like tourism and fishing. Rehashing the roadless rule debate isn't a step moving forward. But he says more public discussion is better than some of Senator Lisa Murkowski's latest efforts on the Tongass.
That is much preferable, I think, to a budget appropriations rider that doesn't have that same type of public involvement.
Last November, Murkowski attached a rider to the Senate Interior Appropriations Bill that could exempt Alaska from the roadless rule. Congress has until February 8 to agree on a budget. In the meantime, the State Division of Forestry is keeping its fingers crossed that one of those efforts sticks. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. You can nominate your favorite teacher at bpteachers.com. The deadline is February 1st. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside of Alaska, and it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Although Sitka's dreams of selling bulk water on the world market haven't amounted to anything, the community has made quite a bit of cash not selling water. Gary White told the Sitka Chamber of Commerce that Sitka has made almost $1.5 million selling water rights, and he's still getting calls. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Sitka has an enormous storage tank for water, White said to a full house at the Chamber of Commerce. It's called Blue Lake. The reservoir now supplies the bulk of Sitka's hydroelectric needs and all of the community's drinking water, with about 9.5 billion, with a B, gallons to spare. Since 2009, a succession of entrepreneurs and speculators has paid to reserve the right to export that excess water. But none, to use legal terms, has performed.
And we haven't sold a drop of water, but folks have been, it's been such a competitive thing that folks have been willing to pay us money to have the right to have a contract to export water.
The total is about $1.5 million so far, with another $90,000 due from the latest player, Arctic Blue Water Alaska, Inc. The day after the chamber luncheon, White notified the board of Sitka's industrial park that Arctic's payment was overdue, and the company will have 45 days to pay or the contract would be canceled. White told the board, they're probably going to come up with the cash. So why do investors keep coming back to Sitka's water? Clearly, there are catastrophic water shortages occurring in places like Cape Town, South Africa. But no one's found an economically viable pathway for using Sitka's surplus to address shortages in other parts of the world. Factoring in shipping costs, which White says can be about 3 cents per gallon, desalination technology becomes more affordable. Nevertheless, White describes desalinated water as chemically dead. He told the chamber that there are businesses who see a different niche for Sitka's water.
Right now, I've been having conversations with a group out of Costa Rica, which is an interesting thing is that they actually market water with high-end coffee and tea, and someone's willing to pay for this. I don't know who is, but I mean, I buy my coffee at a gas station, but some people like to, you know, the high-end coffees, and so They're willing to pay for a high-end water to go with their high-end coffee. And the reason that he called us from Costa Rica was that the ideal pH for coffee water is 6.9 pH. Our water is 6.9 pH. So apparently we have great water for coffee. We also have a really low total dissolved solid content in our water, which also makes it really great for coffee and just drinking overall.
Just recently, the contractor completed work on a new 250-foot floating dock at Sitka's Industrial Park, adjacent to the 24-inch bulk water line that could conceivably load a Panamax cargo ship one day. White thinks the dock will be a game changer once the economics of water have been resolved. Someday, I'm still convinced that we're going to be able to sell our water, he said, but it won't be this year. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska-grown band Portugal the Man won its first Grammy last night at the Recording Academy's 60th annual awards show. The band's founding members, John Gourley and Zach Carruthers, are from Alaska and met at Wasilla High School, where they started playing music together. They're joined by fellow Alaskan Eric Hauk, as well as Kyle O'Quinn and Jason Sechrist. Based in Portland, the band is known for music often described as alternative, but they took the Grammy Award for Best Pop Duo or Group Performance with their catchy song, Feel It Still. It was their first ever Grammy nomination. In accepting the award last night, Carruthers mentioned growing up in small-town Alaska.
This is crazy for us. Our heroes were dog mushers and stuff like that. This is nuts.
Along with some on-stage shenanigans by the band, Carruthers also briefly shared the band's appreciation for Alaska Native culture and gave shout-outs to several rural Alaska communities.
Shishmaref, Barrow, Bethel, all the indigenous people in Alaska and around the world. You're beautiful. Your culture is beautiful. Thank you for inspiring us. And yeah, man, rep where you're from. Be proud of who you are and where you're from.
Feel It Still spent weeks at the top of music charts, peaking at number 4 on the Billboard Hot 100. At the Grammys, it beat out other songs with heavy radio play, including Despacito by Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee featuring Justin Bieber, and Thunder by Imagine Dragons. As of today, Feel It Still is at 23 on the Hot 100. And that's it for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Rasha McChesney, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Teresa Castorillas in Bethel, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Casey Grove in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Ann Hillman. Have a lovely evening.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.